You're listening to CJLO 1690 AM Montreal.
You're listening to CJLO News. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Adam Innes.
Hey everyone, this is Sonic Lit, a spoken web radio show on CJLO 1690. And I'm here with Catherine McLeod, and we're about to give you a little sampling of what formal, serious sound poetry sounds like as a way into thinking about how would one go about actually parroting sound poetry.
Femps bavate tseu pagif kvie. The desnanariem puff tilfto till you come. Rinsick at the baby and skirmy. Tsu and tsu rinskirmy. Racket baby.
Hey, Catherine. How's it going?
Hey, Jason. It's it's really great to be back in the studio. I was out in BC for a couple of weeks, and we haven't hosted a show together since early July.
I know. Yeah. It's really nice to be back, and the weather is beautiful out there, so it's a great way to come back.
It is. It's also not too hot in the studio today, so far. We'll see by the end of the show.
No, it's really cool in here, actually.
And we're listening to some cool sounds. This is sound poetry.
Well, this is sort of benchmark of sound poetry. It's Kurt Schwitters, his Ursonaut, which was written and performed initially from 1922 to 1932. This particular recording that we're listening to is Christopher Butterfield, who's one of many sound poet performers, including Christian Bach, Yap Blanc, who have made their names in the 21st century as performers of the Schwitters Ursonaut. And this genre is called sound poetry.
It almost, it reminds me of how in classical music, there's certain compositions that, say, pianists really must kind of master or perform. And, sometimes in poetry, we don't necessarily hear covers of other people's poems. But in the case of this poem, this has been a poem that's been covered by different sound poets. And it feels like a poem that almost like if you can cover this poem, you've reached some sort of higher level of sound poetry.
Well, you make a really good point because Schwitters did write a score for this piece, and so it can be performed by different people interpreting his score. And the score represents different kinds of glottal sounds and other kinds of vocal sounds that are not semantic, but sounds that we can make with our mouths and our voices and our tongues. So you're right. And it gives it also a kind of classical music feel, right? You know, the way it's presented, the way it's performed, with a score in front of them. It's serious.
Yeah,
stuff.
There's like a reverence, like, oh, we're going to hear Ursonaut. This is a serious piece.
Yeah. So today's show is the exact antithesis to the seriousness of Kurt Schwitters Ursonaut. I was really fortunate to recently gone to Coburg. Not necessarily fortunate for having been in Coburg, but to visit a
the
friend of mine.
Of sound poetry.
But to visit poet Stuart Ross, who lives there now, and to leave my visit with a couple of cassette tapes in my hand. And one of them was a very rare cassette that was made in 1988 and published by the Underwich Audiographic Series in Toronto, jointly published with Proper Tales Cassette Thing, number one. Proper Tales Press is Stuart Ross's own sort of imprint. And it's a cassette that documents performances from the music gallery in Toronto on January 24th, 1988, when Stuart Ross and Mark Leyba closed a four-day mini festival of Toronto sound poetry. So this is a cassette that documents a sound poetry festival that happened in Toronto. And the closing act was Mark Leyba and Stuart Ross. And they just spent their entire time on stage making fun of sound poetry and the pretensions that surround this particular genre of poetry.
And I'm going to guess, though, that there were probably some sound poets in the room. So they must have done it in a way that was, I guess we'll find out.
Yeah.
But I think there were, just from taking a peek at the tape, like probably there were sound poets.
There weren't just some. Yeah, there were the all the sound poets of Toronto were in the room at the closing performance of this mini festival of sound poetry, which I think in their minds was a really big deal, a really big thing. Sound poetry, you know, had really been brought to the canlit scene by the Four Horsemen. We've talked about this in previous shows. And in fact, B.P. Nichol, who is one of the four in the Four Horsemen, introduces and I think hosted this entire festival and introduces Stuart and Mark. So Stuart Ross and Mark Leyba.
Wow. Well, I'm excited to hear or be transported back to 1988 in the music gallery with this recording.
Yeah, so what we're going to hear, I'm going to play a few sections. And the first is just, there's this cassette thing, this Proper Tales cassette thing. And this is the little introduction that Stuart and Ross created for the cassette before we then will move to the live recording. So let's see if we can hear this first. And I want to rewind it. We actually have a tape player in the studio and a real cassette. And we're going to give that a listen.
When we were young lads growing up in Bathurst Manor, me and Stu converted my old wagon into a traveling insect cemetery. Business was bad in those days, even though Stu's family had changed their name from Rozovsky to Ross, and we were forced to create our own cadavers. We'd like to dedicate this tape to those insects. Stu, would you like to say a few words about our writing?
Yes, Mark, I would. Some of our poems are quite short. Many of them are long, but not as long as others. Some of them are very short, but were written on long paper. In certain instances, more than one sheet of paper was needed, but we're still pretty happy with them. Right, Mark?
Right, Stu. So we hope all you out there enjoy our efforts in trying to bring you a satisfying consumer product.
All right, so that was called, that's track one on this cassette on side A, because you know tapes have side A and side B. That's intro to fine consumer product, and that's the little introduction. Now, let's not forget about Kurt Schwitters.
Back over there.
He's still going there. It's a long piece, and so, you know, it'll be going on, and we'll come back to him now and again.
Sounds
when
good.
We want to.
Just to remind ourselves.
Yeah.
high sound poetry. Well, also, I should say that Jason is reading, for the cassette tape, he's reading off of the paper liner notes from the tape itself. So I feel like we're really, the cassette is very present here in the room with us. So he's just opening up, flipping through, what happens next on this tape? Or do you want to tell us a little bit more about the
I'm interested to hear what you think about that introduction so far.
Well, I have to say I felt like I laughed at, so definitely I'm already sort of in the mood for if they're going to be doing something that's a bit of a parody. I'm ready for that. I did laugh, especially at the part about the poem being perhaps on more than one piece of paper, and it's still a good poem, even though it takes up that much space.
Yeah, it was kind of a joke about length, which we were talking about, right? So the Ursinet is this really long piece. It's a 45-minute piece in different movements, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of sense already a little bit of a jab at conceptual writing, where maybe you write something based on the material on which, you know, you're writing it, so that basically the length of the poem is determined by something outside of your own will.
Yeah, right? And also sort of this that sometimes conceptual poets might write on multiple pieces of paper, but the writing might be very small and it might actually use up many sheets, but produce sort of very small piece of writing. So that it feels like they're maybe making a little bit of fun of that too.
Yeah, and on the inside flap of this little paper cassette J card that I'm holding, it does indicate that track one, which we just listened to, which didn't sound live at all, had a little bit of reverb on the voices, you might have heard. That was produced along with a few tracks at the end of the tape. It produced and engineered by Sean Richards in his Groggy Zealot mobile studio in the spring of 1987. So that introduction to the tape was recorded before their actual performance. So it seems like they had been planning this tape in advance of doing the live performance, and they were planning to take that live recording and make a tape out of it. But they had already written the introduction to the tape before they even did the show. And I think what we're going to do now is move right into the first part of their performance. We're going to hear BP Nickel introduce them.
Okay, so now we're really kind of going back to that live space. We'll see.
Imagine
if
yourself,
that.
If you can, in the music gallery in Toronto on January the 24th, 1988, listening to the final act, the final performance of a four-day mini festival of Toronto sound poetry. I just want to say, 4 days of sound poetry, that's a lot of sound poetry. Some might say that's too much sound poetry. I don't know. For everyone, though. Some people love sound poetry.
Yeah. Also thinking, like, in the 80s, like this, like as you already suggested, it was like the heyday of sound, you know, sound poetry in Canada with groups like the Four Horsemen. But also I remember hearing the poet Lillian Allen, who we've heard tracks from her recordings of dub poetry here on this very show, and her talking about how, like, she was there, like, I'm sure she was there in this room too, and just thinking about how, you know, a gathering like that would have really brought together so many different artists in Toronto and beyond Toronto, but really Toronto in the 80s. So kind of, you know, imagining that space, who could all be in the room in that moment?
Yeah, exactly. So we'll hear BP Nickel, and then we're going to hear on the cassette, it's marked as, this is really a sketch that they're going to perform about their theory of sound poetry prior to doing any sound poems, which only begin to be heard on side B of this tape. So the whole first side is an interview sketch.
Yeah.
And the title they give to it is, "The Word Hits You in the Head Like a Large Boot."
Welcome to the second half of the final night of the Toronto Mini Festival of Toronto Sound Poetry. The final performers are two quite remarkable writers, Stuart Ross and Mark Lava. Stuart has at least 15 or 20 various books, pamphlets, and things to his credit. Mark, I've lost count of, but he has a remarkable range of things, comic strips, poems, found texts, and so on, including the Mac Bolan poems, one of my personal favorites, which won the National Chapbook Award. And Stuart, of course, was the unofficial winner 1 year of the 3-day novel contest. If they'd given a winner, he would have gotten it, but they didn't give a winner. Such is fate. Those of you who have seen Eli Netrikoff's movie Street Writers have seen the Stuart Ross Mark Lava duo perform, but now you're going to see them in an extended set. So without further ado.
All the sounds you hear are going to be part of the performance. So nothing that's being played is a mistake.
As I'm listening to this, Jason, this is the music that is also played in the short film that was made of Elimination Dance, a poem by Michael Ondaatje. And this makes me think, He must have been here listening to this, and maybe it inspired that choice.
Very possible.
Good evening, I'm Harold Valdez, and welcome to The Word Kicks You in the Head Like a Large Boot. You've just heard an excerpt from the new Phenomenal Ensemble audio tape. And we have with us today Mark Lava, who along with fellow sound poet Stuart Ross has formed the Bathurst Manor Research Group, dedicated to explorations of ontogenetic placebic language libraries. Mark, I've got a map in front of me here, and I've got a location for Bathurst Manor. It's here a bit south of Willowdale. We have Finch on the north. To the south is Shepherd Avenue. It goes way as far over as, some say, Bathurst to the east, and Dufferin over to the west. Mark, did you have any comments on it? Do I have that right?
Well, I have to say, Stu, that the question of boundaries of the manor is in constant flux. As a child, I could remember the old conscious boundaries developed within the language of that time, but now with the enlargement of Yorkdale, probably one of the largest parking lots in the world, we can safely say the boundaries have extended, perhaps as far as Edmund Scientific.
Past the York Bowl Around.
Past the York Bowl Around. With an actual physical division of the structure of the manor by the ravine that cuts through the center.
That's astonishing. You're a pretty amazing guy, actually.
Well, the probing question is.
Yeah, thank you. You and Stuart have been working on sound poetry. You've known each other since you were 3 years old. You've been working on sound poetry for a little over a decade now. Do you feel that with your sound poetry and your performance work, you have the power to change things, to actually change society itself, to find the homeless a home and clothe the naked?
I think so, Stu. I think... I'm sorry. I think that we are attempting to reproduce the rapidness of our perceptions by bringing things to a macro-syntactical alignment. I think that other people can use this for their own advancement.
Are you saying that you can actually, with your work, help the starving of Ethiopia?
I think so. I think the insistence of changing patterns will help them to understand our language and thus, in turn, perhaps help them to feed themselves.
Those are noble intentions, Mark. I understand that you and Stuart actually plan to travel to Nicaragua, lead sound poetry workshops for the peasants on the border, who are at present under attack by the CIA-funded Contras.
Well, that's true. We have been in contact. Unfortunately, the Sandinistas didn't get back to us. And then, of course, Stuart started receiving threatening letters from the CIA. William Casey, or not signed by him, I guess it's a stamped
rubber stamp.
A rubber stamp kind of thing. Which scared us quite a bit, and so we backed off. And we were hoping to run down there and open up a sound poetry boot camp, so to speak.
You're afraid of that, Mark. Look, why don't you shut up for a second? Let me go on.
Of course.
with your work in sound poetry, I think what you're saying is that you've actually unleashed a power that really we're not able to understand. Did you know when you began in the work of sound poetry, following the likes of Bissett, Nickel, and that whole, all those guys? Did you realize that you'd be, unleashing something like that? The Libyans themselves are now working on ontological experiments based on your own work.
That's very true.
And when these third world countries start grasping the explorations of language, I mean, there's no who can monitor them?
That's it. What we found is the sound poetry waves have been slipping under the radar screens. And somehow, of course, they are sneaking in there. I think we feel very much like Einstein felt after he created the formula for the atomic bomb and didn't understand the monstrous means that it would be used to. Right now, terrorists in Libya, using the groundwork here in Canada, are using sound poetry, bouncing the sound waves off of satellites to blow up airplanes. And I urge sound poets to hold back on their emissions because they could be used for very dangerous causes.
You yourself, you talked about radar now. You yourself, I believe it was in 1986, flew a ontological narrative sound poem over the U.S.-Canada border and landed right in front of the White House, and you actually were able to pass by all the defense radars the U.S. had set up.
That's true. I was arrested for that as I landed on the inside of the gates. And what I was doing was creating the polemical structure, the duality of moralism itself. And unfortunately, I was arrested in the process.
I know Nancy's a big Owen Sound fan, though, so
yeah.
I'm sort of surprised. You know, last week, Mark, I was speaking to Rafael Geraldo Rivera. He told me that the Four Horsemen were working on a First Strike sound poem. And you can, if you go back to works of Rivera's as far back as Incomprehensive Babel, you can actually see that they were working up to something as dangerous as this. I'm frightened.
I am frightened too. I'm frightened for the world and for the people who I don't think they understand the deadly use that their language is being put to. In a sense, they're creating the ontology of terror itself. And I believe that this very much uses force.
Yeah, that's good. I know that you've brought some new work with us. You recently applied for an explorations grant from the Canada Council to do a sound text reading of the birthmark on Gorbachev's head,
yes.
Following up on your political interests in literature and politics.
That's right.
Is it true that you've got a holographic image of Gorbachev's forehead?
Yes, but the Canada Council gratefully donated money for me to have a holographic image made of the birthmark, which kind of is suspended in the center of my living.
But are you sure it's not, in fact, a liver spot? Because
well,
if it's a liver spot, the entire text itself, the tensions
well, yes,
in the text really change.
It would change. I mean, it would change the synchronic efforts that I'm putting to it. But, you know, I got together with medical people, and we had spectrograms done of his head, and we found, yes, it is a birthmark. It is not a liver spot. And hopefully, I mean, Gorbachev has sent his regards, and we hope the poem is read in Red Square, perhaps draw a big audience like Yevstashenko does. And I think it's a very polemic piece.
You brought some of it with us, with
yeah.
you today, Mark. But you know what I wanted to, so if I could quote Steve McCaffrey in a recent collection of essays on
not the most radical of writers.
No, he's a conservative. But in his book North of Intention, East of Bathurst Manor, he had a in his essay Party Leader's Head as Text, a Derridean analysis of the work of Laba. He reviews your piece. It's a 350-page chapter written before you've actually completed your own piece, which I find astonishing. But fair.
Absolutely fair in the sense that it is writing itself in the process that the writing is writing itself.
He calls you an immoral swine in that piece.
An immoral swine, yes. And I can understand that in a sense because he's a reactionary and he's a scared one.
Yes. Why don't you read to us from your piece now?
Okay. This is the excerpt from the second stanza. Ganga! And that, in turn, that's the echoing of the doubt between the birthmark and the liver spot. It goes on to say, Ganga! Which is the building up of the duality of moralism and into which, as Carl Jurgens has pointed out to me, is the very orthography, the intertextual shifts, the gestalt of order itself.
All right, we're going to stop in mid-interview, and we got to hear, finally, some of Mark Leyba's actual sound poetry, an interpretation of the birthmark on Gorbachev's head. What do you think about this, Catherine?
What a question. Thanks, Jason. Well, throughout listening, I couldn't help but think about the way that the audience that they're performing for in that moment in time in 1988 at the Music Gallery after a four-day sound poetry conference, they were performing for the ideal audience who would have just been getting all of their jokes and laughing along, knowing that like Steve McCaffrey, who was referenced, would be sitting right there, probably in the front row. And just every single joke that they wove in, we got a lot of them, but knowing that audience would have just been like, it spoke to them. It also spoke to our show in many ways, because I feel like we've been taking you on a journey through sound poetry on this first year of Sonic Lit, a spoken web radio show, and we've been playing a lot of the poets that they gave little mentions to. So I feel like I enjoyed it and did laugh at a lot of the jokes because of how much sound poetry we've been listening to.
Yeah.
Oh, what about, he's still going. Kurt Schwitters.
Yes, but we're going to take a little break now. 1690 CJLO. This is Sonic Lit, a spoken web radio show. And we'll be right back with the second half of that interview and some more parodic sound poetry and sound poetry of the very serious kind as well.
Dive into the ultimate comic haven at Crossover Comics. Unleash your inner geek with the best selection of graphic novels, manga, games like Pokemon and Magic, in-store events, merch, and more. Our knowledgeable and friendly staff have got your back with awesome recommendations for your next read. Score big with a free account. Enjoy comic subscriptions and membership discounts. Be in on the action at 3560 Notre Dame West in St. Henry, right near Metro Lionel Brew. Crossover Comics, sharing your passions since 2012.
We're back, and you're listening to Sonic Lit, a spoken web radio show. I am Catherine McLeod, and I'm here in the studio with Jason Camelot, and we are listening to sound poetry, but sound poetry that is parodying itself. And really, it's a really fun recording that we've been listening to so far from 1988, recorded at the Music Gallery, Stuart Ross and Mark Laba delivering the final keynote presentation or performance of poetry and commentary on sound poetry, and having a lot of fun while they're at it. We're going to sort of jump back in, I think, where we left off.
I'm going to try to find. That's the beginning. We're going to try to get to somewhere in the middle. Maybe we left off at Gorbachev.
Yeah.
But we're just going to jump ahead randomly, which seems appropriate. This is a very improvisational interview. We should say the interviewer of Mark Laba. Who is explaining the collaborative work of Mark Laba and Stuart Ross. The interviewer is actually Stuart Ross pretending to be someone else.
That's
right?
And Jason recently saw Stuart Ross this summer and got this tape directly from him.
Yeah, so let's just, you know, let's move ahead a little bit and we'll play a bit more.
Sounds
of this.
Good.
Yeah.
To Ross's book, divided into four volumes by Coach House Press to help fulfill grant obligations or some such thing. I don't really understand that completely. But your collection, your essay, 700 pages, you wrote it in one night.
One night, yeah. Yes.
You wrote a reaction to Ross's Men with Glass Noses Shouldn't Blow Their Noses. In fact, Ross's original 12-page article was Men with Glass Noses Shouldn't Use Kleenex. You've written a 700-page thing based on an error on your own part.
Yes, that's true, but I believe if we cannot validate our errors with Canada Council money, then how can we achieve any kind of art? As Stuart said, art is the mud between your toes. It's the mucus in your nose. You know, when I feel when the semantics are flowing, you got to keep going.
Yeah, that's... You're a really great guy. You're incredible. Let's move on to something else.
Sure.
The Nicky Drombolis bookstore reading.
Yes.
Okay. No one, in fact, was in attendance at this event. Nicky himself was in France getting new first editions books. No one was there.
He didn't even know.
You and Stuart prepared for weeks for this reading. You did a three-hour performance. You actually had to break into the bookstore itself in the middle of the night. You broke the back window where you landed in the washroom.
Right.
Breaking down the washroom door itself,
door, so to speak,
to get into the body of the bookstore. Then you proceeded to perform a 3-hour performance consisting of boiling eggs to an empty room.
Yes. Well, I think that piece was capitulated in the bubbling of the eggs and the translation against the walls of books and how language can rebound itself. And of course, Stuart finalized the piece by smearing the eggs on the books themselves.
The first edition books?
The first edition. Of course, they had to be the first edition.
That's sort of a fuck materialism statement.
Exactly. Breaking down of mythology itself, the intentions of it. And I thought it went quite well. At one point, a wino had come by and began drooling on the window.
He was on the outside of the store.
He was on, he was on the outside of the store and began drooling on the window. And we immediately did a homolinguistic translation of the drool itself. But like I say, why have an audience when we are there to listen anyway? And that's what it's about.
You know, you two who were once so concerned with audience, I mean, you went so far as to publish a six-part mystery serialized novel in One Magazine, which is kind of an answer to Reader's Digest. It's a mainstream...
It was a weak moment. We kind of sold out there.
And now you've grown to doing readings with no audience whatsoever. On the other hand, a man that both you and Ross have worked with, J.W. Curry.
Mr. Curry, yes.
Who once used to do things so obscure. He used to rubber stamp editions of things, editions of 4 or 5 copies, to be distributed to his children and his wife. What he's done now, I understand, he's constructed a giant car, a giant vehicle in the shape of the letter A. Yes. And he's been known now at some insane breakdown, we don't know what it is, he's driving up and down Yonge Street in this giant letter A, trying to reach as large an audience as possible.
Yes.
How do you account for the dichotomy?
Well, I don't quite understand what Mr. Curry is getting at in this. I guess he's trying to bring the compositional descriptions out to the public, and perhaps he's risking something, combining the mechanics of language with the actual mechanics of the car itself, so that you have to keep a balance between the physical world and the actual written.
You know, Mark. Want to hear something?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
So I was standing at the side of Yonge Street near College, or College Carleton, and waiting for Curry, in fact, to drive by. I saw him about a block away, actually taking an oil dip. Of the letter A, an oil dip of language itself.
That's right, in a sense that what he's doing. He's taking an oil dip of language itself, of the engine parts, creating into it his own language, an integration. And I fear for him. I fear for these experiments, because it could become dangerous. He could get his arm caught in the engine or something, and his language is so fully integrated he would have no words to speak out to say, "Help me get my arm out." And I fear for this experiment.
Curry is the Evel Knievel of Canadian concrete poetry.
Recently I heard that he may be jumping the A vehicle over the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
And
I'll be there for that.
I want to go on now,
and you're babbling on and on. One of the most oft-discussed quotes from your own work, your oeuvre, your travail, is the quote. Are you listening, Mark?
Listen
to this.
I'm there.
Are you listening?
I'm there.
Okay, got the wax out of your ears?
Yes.
Okay, watch. Listen.
I'm ready.
Ready?
Okay.
This is it. This is your line, Mark. You said this. It is time for the potato hop.
Yes.
Whew! Oh!
I had to dig. I dug deep for that one. I was invalid for a week. I had to be force-fed with a spoon, I eventually hospitalized. Stuart read the line and fell into somewhat of a coma after that, in which I don't know if he's quite recovered. But
totally screwed up your digestive system.
Exactly, because I was reaching into the archetypal digestion of language, moving into the paramecums that move their way through its intricate networks. And as Stuart himself said, we were all once amoebas. I was picked up off the floor after that. In fact, the whole audience was picked up.
Getting back to your line, the potato hop line, I read in a recent Chatelaine, I don't know when it was written. It was written by Victor Coleman or Victor Dorr or Brian Dodora, one of those guys. Chatelaine, he said, on the creation of that line, Mark Lopp proceeded to vomit for 6 days, and Stuart Ross fell into a coma that has so far lasted 2 months. Can there be this kind of validation for language?
I think there can be this kind of validation. I believe that if you reach into the structure of it itself and mush around all those enzymes,
yeah,
in a sense, the vomit itself becomes the validation.
You know, you're going to be reading with Seward at the upcoming mini sound thing in,
yes,
Toronto.
Yes.
And you're getting a $100 fee to be divided between the two of you. Stuart is in a coma. So you have decided to take $60, whereas Stuart in the coma only gets $40.
Well, yes, there is some... I think that's fair. Stuart has been in a coma now for a while. The only word that's come out of him is burbling. We don't know quite what he's, yeah, getting at. Maybe he's creating some evolutionary passage of his past. We don't know the gastritis of his being. So I think it's only fair, because we don't know the state Stuart will be in when he gets up here.
Stuart's coma.
Fair that I take.
On the topic of Stuart's coma, I was reading in a recent, it was a 4-volume series of open letters. Frank Davey was devoting the first volume, Takeout Service, devoted to the works of Robert Service,
mm-hmm,
and the next volume devoted to his own King of Swords. A series of things on the long poem, The Shooting of Sam McGee, King of Swords,
right,
Martyrology,
comparable to the Gilgamesh and the Kalevala, too.
Yeah. Well, he compared Stuart's coma, he called it a 2-month extended coma poem, punctuated with the word burble. Sort of a long poem of unconsciousness.
Yes, in a sense, Stuart has, and he warned
a long poem of unconsciousness, a coma poem.
Oh, we're listening to a recording that was made in 1988, and the long poem was really big in that moment in Canlit. So
it sure was. Yeah.
It's that makes me think back to the beginning, the joke, early joke about using multiple sheets of paper, and like, oh, this is a long poem joke in that as well. So Jason, I responded the first time around, but I want to ask you, what do you notice when you're listening to this recording?
Yeah, well, I agree with everything that you heard, which is sort of trying to imagine how this is a performance that has probably the most inside jokes that any literary performance could possibly have.
Yes.
Just because anyone who could get most of the jokes that are being made on stage here are among those people who are in the audience who would have been in attendance. You know.
Yeah.
But another thing, a more personal kind of thing, when I first heard this, it kind of blew my mind, because I have done some collaborations with Stuart over the years. I edited 2 of Stuart's poetry books. And for the second of those two, the first was Dead Cars in Nicaragua, and they were talking about Nicaragua and the Sandinistas. And I think it was around that time that he did that trip that, you know, resulted in the book that I edited, mm-hmm, for him. But then the second one is called A Hamburger in a Gallery. Mm-hmm. And I proposed to Stuart, after this very surrealist collection of poems, that I interview him, but that I interview him in a manner where I play the most naive, really least knowledgeable interviewer imaginable, and he play the most deadpan, earnest poet responding to the questions I ask him about the poems in his book. We went to a restaurant, and I turned on a tape recorder. Well, I think it was a digital recorder, and I interviewed him for a couple of hours. And we ended up publishing a transcript of that interview, and you know, it was called The Stupid Interview. And basically, that's the last part of the book, is this interview about the book that everyone would have just read if they bought the book. And I had no idea that Stuart had been doing parodic interviews as part of his literary practice, you know, for decades already. When I did this with Stuart, which was in the 2000s, this interview, this performance dates back to 1988. So that really blew my mind. Is that like what I was doing with him, which I thought, oh, this is going to be really fun and sort of new for Stuart. Nah, this is old hat for him. He'd been doing it forever.
He was an expert.
That's right.
Well, I'd love to hear a recording of that someday. Maybe we'll have to bring that onto the show.
Yeah, we could. I mean, the transcript has been published, but the recording has never been released. Thing number two cassette, cassette thing number two for that one.
Yeah. Well, it seems like a moment to release something back on cassette tape. So, we'll look forward to hearing the story of that.
Especially since we now have the tape player back and working in the in the studio here.
Exactly. So
I think we left off at a great spot to move on to side B of the tape.
Right, when they're going to read. But okay, I have a question. Are they going to read in their characters that they're performing, or are they going to read as themselves? Or
insofar as their characters are Stuart Roth and Mark Leyba, absolutely. If the question behind your question is, are they going to be doing sound poetry with any seriousness? I think so. I think that they're doing their version of sound poetry, but their serious version of sound poetry is one that takes humor and the comedic aspects of sound poetry seriously. And it's not to say that the Four Horsemen didn't also...
Yeah, they also have some pretty funny poems.
Very funny poems. Yeah. And so I think that, you know, any kind of disruptive speech as a motor performance is inevitably going to evoke laughter, you know, because those are embarrassing things, disruptors. When I say disruptors, I mean like sneezes or coughs or, you know, all these things that aren't supposed to happen when you're speaking and using language. Right.
And so often, sometimes, you know, people hearing sound poetry for the first time might think that it sounds funny, but feel a bit awkward about, like, am I supposed to laugh? Am I not? Like, say if we're listening to Kurt Schwitters here and thinking, am I supposed to laugh, or should I just be listening in complete silence and reverence? And it can be hard to know, so it's nice to know that you can have some fun with it too.
Are we listening? Should we be listening to this as we would listen to Schoenberg,
right?
Which would be maybe some equivalent. Should we be listening to it with admiration for the technical prowess and the compositional prowess that goes into actually constructing a piece like this, but at the same time acknowledging that these sounds are funny, you know, and they're funny because they make us confront all of the decorum that really frames the way we use language and speech.
Okay, well, I'm excited to hear some of these poems from side B.
Yeah, I think before we do that, let's listen to this, and then we're going to come back and begin side B of the special tape, which actually has the title Preacher Explodes During Sermon, which has nothing to do with anything, but that seems appropriate. We'll be right back after this.
Au cinéma public, nous proposons une programmation en salle composée de films d'ici et de nouveautés internationales, de classiques et des pépites méconnues, ainsi que de courts-métrages et des séances familiales. Nos billets sont parmi les moins chers à Montréal, 10$ au tarif régulier et 8$ pour les étudiants, les enfants et les aînés. Nous offrons également des cinécartes de 6 billets pour encore plus d'économies. Venez nous voir à la Casa d'Italia, juste en face de la station Jean Talon. Et rendez-vous au cinémapublic.ca pour découvrir notre programmation. Le cinéma public pour un cinéma vivant.
This is a piece. Hernando begins to rave and talk to himself in Yukon 1896. This is based on original manuscripts we found of an old gold rush explorer, and Stuart and I just kind of translated his diary words into this piece. Hernando begins to rave and talk to himself in Yukon 1896.
It is the cold in the river, the river, the river flows down, is the mouth of the sky. Tonight the moon shines dim on this river, this river, Hernando, this river, Hernando. Where are my feet? They're cold, lie down, Hernando. On the river tonight, the river flows fast, and the moon shines dim on the river, shines night on the river, the river shines dim on the river tonight. Night, Hernando lies dead in the vice by the river. His hands were stung night in the river last night. Hernando lies dead in the vice by the river. The moon shines night for Hernando lies dead.
harken back to our roots now with a traditional Welsh folk song. Welsh folk song. This is my head. This is my head. This is my head arranged in the flowers, or arranged in the flowers. This is my head.
This is my head.
On the beach in Malibu, see all the pretty
this
women.
Is my
this is my head. This is my head.
Arranged
where it belongs. Where it belongs is where I put it. Yes, you in the green eye. Yes, this is my head.
This is my head.
This is my head motionless.
This is my head.
This is my head moving. This is my head arranged
on the
in the flowers.
In
yes, you in the back corner. Ah, yes, this. This is my head. This is my head. This is my head arranged in the flowers.
This is my head.
Is it arrange your head in some way? Arrange
this
your head in the flowers. This is my head. This is my head arranged in a corner. Arranged in the corner on the shelf below the photos. Yes, you. You in the green eye.
This is my head.
This is my head motionless.
This is my head.
This is my head arranged in the flowers. This is my head arranged in the flowers.
We're listening to Stuart Ross and Mark Leiber.
We were going to do our Ross and Labadou Gershwin translations today, but we decided instead to go for something a little more obscure. This is a couple of outtakes from West Side Story. These didn't actually appear in the actual Broadway. We heard they were writing it, the play. We submitted these pieces and they were rejected. It's a two-part piece. Jimmy suffers from depression, a writing. Jimmy is sad. Jimmy is sitting sad with his head in his hand. Jimmy is crying. Jimmy is sitting crying with his head in his hands. Jimmy, cheer up. Cheer up, Jimmy. Come on, Jimmy, don't feel bad. Once in a while, we all feel sad. Jimmy, feel better. Feel better, Jimmy. We love you and want you back again. We want you out in the streets again. We want you back with the gang again. We love you, Jimmy. Cheer up. Cheer up. Jimmy's monologue.
Guana wana ikawa, ikawana wana ikawa, ikawana ikawa, inawana ikawana.
Freddy derelict spot all over my iguana.
In a
Christ, it made me weep. I sat in the gutter and wet around the assholes with pool cues, dancing to Chinese ballets, leaping back and forth from trash and dead dogs. It gives me no sense of satisfaction with things like that happen. I'm a simple sort of guy, like a Jacob or an Esau or something. And my iguana just thinks he's a kid. Cuddly, Christ, not threatening. My uncle used to tell me about some fucking amoeba things that split up and caused pretty bad things to your insides.
So those two reject poems that were rejected from West Side Story, the musical, seem to me really interesting example of the kind of sound poetry they're trying to do, because we were just talking while that was playing, that in addition to having the sound poem being performed, the other poet, in this case, Mark Labba, is doing the sound poem in that last piece mm-hmm. we heard. And Stuart Ross is doing a kind of simultaneous translation of what the sound poem might actually be saying in semantic language, which is in some ways what everyone dreams of having when they're listening yeah. to a sound poem, because we just want to understand. We mm-hmm. want meaning, right? And so sound poetry, which is so evasive of meaning, like sort of
working very much against the possibility of having sound mean, they're giving us the satisfaction of, you know, having a translation like that.
Mm-hmm. It also, that makes me think of the way that it is, it's a collaboration, and you, Jason, having collaborated with Stuart Ross, thinking of just like how Stuart, how he works collaboratively, and just thinking of like what would it have looked like to sort of plan this, and also then to perform the poem again, not as they're both collaboratively making the sounds at the same time and overlapping, which a lot of sound poets do, but yeah, one is like the translator of the other's sounds, which is a really unique kind of collaboration in sound poetry, and one that you don't often hear or see.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's a good point that Stuart is a lifelong literary collaborator. That's an important part of his process. He's constantly collaborating. He's been coming to Montreal very regularly the last 5 years because he has a series of collaborations happening with people in this city, myself included, but you know, with musicians, painters, filmmakers, and writers, and other performers. And I think we're going to hear that him and Mark Labba, who he had known from a very young age, were able to pretty much do anything, you know, without really embarrassing each other, and just sort of enjoy making very kooky sketches and skits and poems.
Yeah, they seem like collaborators, really in tune with each other, and really like they can. I don't know. Yeah, like their comedy, their humor is so in sync, but also like they can deliver things in almost like a deadpan way, when just like the other person's not going to just like break that. Just they can really perform so well together. Just what's a tiny note on it too. It also we were thinking about all the sort of in jokes in the room. It also made me think a lot about literary theory in the 80s, and like thinking about language and like what, you know, the words that you know, the audience would sometimes laugh when, oh, they're going to do a homolinguistic translation of the window markings and things like that. All those things were, you know, big words in language theory and poetics in the 80s. Well, they continue to be, but it's particularly also kind of, you know, doing a parody of theories of language in that moment in time too, which you can also get those jokes if you're listening in and a literary critic.
Yeah, exactly. So we had just heard from Side B, some of the first tracks that are on Side B. Hernando begins to rave and talk to himself in Yukon, 1896. That was the first piece. And on the tape, it does indicate who wrote the piece.
Oh, yeah.
That one was written by Stuart Ross. The next piece we heard was Welsh Folk Song. That one was Ross Labba. So that was a collaborative piece. The next one, which was the first of those West Side Story reject poems, Jimmy Suffers from Depression, A Writing, that's Stuart Ross, and Jimmy's Monologue, Stuart Ross. But that doesn't mean that the sound poetry portion wasn't Labba's improvisational contribution, even though the part with words, were written by Stuart there.
Yeah.
And I'd mentioned earlier that in addition to, there are many other pieces, I'm just going to read through some of the titles because we're not going to have time to listen to them all. The next piece is called Woeful Chicken Cellar Meets Shakespeare. That's a collaborative piece. Then followed by Let's Eat Dinner. Another piece called Jacques Cousteau and the Amazing Wonderful Sea Monkeys. Archaeology Can Be Fun. And Meet People Too, Protein Synthesis, Ode to History, BP Nickel Outros, and Other Things, which is just BP Nickel thanking them and saying that's the end of the festival. Now, I did say that at the end of this tape, they also added some studio recordings that they had made prior to. So these are recordings of some pieces they perform live at this festival, but that they had originally recorded in the studio. And I'd like to end the show playing, at least giving us time to hear one or two of these.
Sounds great.
Okay. So the first of these is one that we just heard. So we're going to have a kind of comparison to how that works. And it's called, once again, it's the one that Jimmy Suffers from Depression, a writing.
Jimmy Suffers from Depression. Jimmy is sad. Jimmy is sitting sad with his head in his hands. Jimmy is crying. Jimmy is sitting, crying, with his head in his hand. Jimmy, cheer up. Cheer up, Jimmy. Come on, Jimmy. Don't feel bad. Once in a while, we all feel sad. Jimmy, feel better. Feel better, Jimmy. We love you and want you back again. We want you out in the streets again. We want you back with the gang again. We love you, Jimmy. Cheer up. Cheer up.
I'm a simple sort of guy. Cruddy derelict slobbered all over my iguana. Christ, it made me weep. I sat in the gutter and wept. Around me, assholes with pool cues, dance scenes from Chinese ballets, leaping back and forth, trash and dead dogs. It gives no sense of satisfaction when things like that happen. I'm a simple sort of guy, like a Jacob or Esau or something. And my iguana just thinks he's a kitten. Cuddly, right? Not threatening. My uncle used to tell me about some fucking amoeba things that split up and cause a pretty bad stench to your insides.
Let the enzymes scrub.
Hemo hemo hemoglobin globin 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 hemo hemo hemoglobin globin.
The enzymes go down into my cells.
Hemo hemo hemoglobin globin.
Then they come back again.
Globin globin hemo hemo hemoglobin.
And they go into my stomach.
Hemoglobin globin
where they were born and bred.
Globin hemo hemo hemoglobin.
And they go into my lungs and make them expand and contract. This is the way of lungs. This is the way of enzymes.
You've been listening to Sonic Lit, a Spoken Web radio show here on 1690 AM on CGLO. We'll see you and hear you next time. Thanks for listening.
Baby born singing Christmas carols.